Well, good day, everyone, and welcome to the Drinker, Biddle, and Reef's inaugural broadcast of Inside the Beltway series. This discussion will be followed by a Q&A session. Audience members who wish to ask a question may press star 1. These instructions will be provided again at the beginning of the Q&A session. And now I will turn things over to Fred and Brad. Please go ahead, gentlemen.
Hello, everybody. This is Fred Reisch, and welcome to the first Inside the Beltway program. I'm an attorney, a benefits attorney at Drinker, Biddle, and Reef. And so is Brad Campbell. Importantly for this program, though, Brad is also the former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, and that's the agency that oversees the fiduciary responsibility and prohibited transactions, guidance, and enforcement, among other things. This is going to be the first of a regular quarterly program, and the concept is that we'll discuss the most up-to-date important and controversial issues inside Washington, D.C., that is inside the Beltway. I think this will be a unique program that will provide a lot of value to you all, since Brad and I are going to have candid discussions about the truly hot topics, and then we're going to, after we've discussed them conceptually, we're going to talk about, you know, some of the practical implications for plan sponsors and service providers to plans. We're going to go for about 45 minutes with our back and forth comments. Then we'll have 15 minutes of questions and answers for you all to queue up and ask your questions of us. The recording will be, this is being recorded, and it will be posted. You'll get an email when it's posted. So somewhere in the next couple of days, you should get an email that the recording has been posted together with a link. In addition to Brad's background as a senior government official in the retirement plan and health and welfare area, our practice in this area, that is our practice inside the Beltway, also includes, among other things, doing comment letters on proposals, doing letters with recommendations for changes, requests for advisory opinions, prohibited transaction exemptions, IRS rulings, educating government officials on private sector concerns, on our issues, on our problems, and on potential solutions, and legal analysis for our clients of the developing trends within the government, of their proposals, and of the final rules that they issue. Brad, with that introduction, let's jump into what you and I agree are the most controversial issues in Washington, D.C., and those are the Department of Labor's guidance on brokerage accounts that came out in a field assistance bulletin and then were subsequently modified, that is, individual brokerage accounts inside participant-directed plans like 401k plans, and then secondly, the DOL's potential reproposal of a regulation that would expand the definition of fiduciary investment advice. I'll start that discussion by talking a little bit about Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-2 and the now infamous question and answer 30. For those of you all who've been following this, you'll remember that the Field Assistance Bulletin came out on May 7th and immediately generated a tremendous reaction from the private sector that Brad will discuss in a little more detail. So very controversial, very fast, and the controversy was very broad-based. The question 30 in the Field Assistance Bulletin dealt with designated investment alternatives for which all kinds of reporting and disclosure has to be done to participants, and with individual brokerage accounts in that context. There are three fairly controversial statements in the Department of Labor's answer. The first was that says that although the regulation, that is the participant disclosure regulation, and for that matter, as far as I know, nothing else in ERISA, does not specifically require that a plan have a particular number of designated investment alternatives, in other words, a finite specified number in the core lineup, the Department of Labor continues, the failure to designate a manageable number of investment alternatives raises questions as to whether the plan fiduciary has satisfied its obligations under Section 404 of ERISA. 404 of ERISA is a section that has the prudent man rule, the duty of loyalty, the exclusive purpose rule, in other words, the operating rules for fiduciary compliance. So what the DOL is saying there, I mean, by the time you cut away the legalese, is that they have real concerns about plans that are where the only investments are brokerage accounts or mutual fund windows. In other words, where there is no core lineup. And they think it could be a breach of fiduciary duty to not offer a core lineup. They went on to explain in the answer, unless participants and beneficiaries are financially sophisticated, many of them may need guidance when choosing their own investments from among a large number of alternatives, that large number of alternatives being a brokerage account or a mutual fund window. That's the first controversial statement. The second controversial statement was that the department said if in a brokerage window or other similar arrangement with a large number of options, there are certain investment options inside those brokerage windows that are selected by a significant number of participants and beneficiaries. They think, the Department of Labor said that they thought there was an affirmative obligation for plan fiduciaries to look inside those brokerage windows, determine if there were a lot of investments that were being made similarly, and determine whether or not one or more of those should be designated investment alternatives that where there has to be disclosure about 1, 5, and 10-year performance, turnover ratio, expense ratios, and so on. So that concept of looking inside the brokerage accounts and identifying investing patterns was highly controversial. The third one was the Department of Labor says, until pending further guidance in this area, in other words, they're thinking about writing some rules, if a platform offers more than 25 investments, then they would say you have to designate at least 3 investment alternatives that satisfy the broad range. And without going into all the details, you would have to make certain other disclosures about any investment alternative in which at least 5 participants invest. In other words, the commonality of investments within the brokerage accounts. Needless to say, there was a lot of pushback. Just a little over two months later, on July 30th, the Department of Labor issued Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-02. Sounds familiar? That's the same number. But then there's an R at the end, -02R. And that revised version of the Field Assistance Bulletin has a new Q&A 39. Q&A 30 disappears. There's nothing there anymore in the new Field Assistance Bulletin. There's a new Q&A 39. It also has 3 interesting points. The first one is they continue to say that the failure to designate investment alternative raises questions about the fiduciary duties of prudence and loyalty. So they're sort of sticking to their guns on what they see as a need to have at least a core lineup. Now they're doing it in a with soft language, but the intent I think is pretty clear. And that goes, 404C won't cure that because we're not talking about how the participants use the investments. We're talking about the failure to designate an investment lineup to begin with. The second point is that they say that fiduciaries are still bound by the duties of prudence and loyalty in selecting the brokerage platform. So they have to go through a prudent process to select and monitor the brokerage platform offered to the participants. You know, interesting question there. That's easy to understand conceptually where there's just one brokerage account provider associated with a record keeper. But what about where each participant is able to pick their own broker dealer? What are the fiduciary responsibilities there? This is worded so broadly that it could pick that up as well. And then third, the Department of Labor essentially says, hey, we're going to go on and we're going to talk with the private sector and we may issue some additional regulations about the selection and monitoring of brokerage accounts and all these issues. The important thing to note, though, is they completely took out the need to look inside the brokerage accounts at the investing patterns. They completely took out the need to if you have more than 25 investment alternatives and you have to designate so many in the following way, that's all gone. There's no longer any duty to look at the commonality of investing patterns inside the brokerage accounts from the Department of Labor's perspective. Brad, I tried to move through that pretty quickly to lay the technical groundwork. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what really happened behind the scenes and where you think we are today.
Yeah, absolutely, Fred. And again, thanks to all of you for joining in on this call, because we're very excited about it. We think there's been so much change and so much movement, and things have been fairly fast-paced for the ERISA world, which normally you think of as not being quite as exciting as it's been the last couple of years. And Q30, the whole issue about how to handle disclosures on brokerage accounts is a good example. And it's an example of how the Labor Department has in the last several years really become, there's really not a whole lot of other words to use other than activist. And it's been questions both of policy and of process. And Q30, this whole brokerage window question, is a great illustration of both. Part of the reason there was such a bipartisan backlash in Congress, with Democratic members of Congress writing letters to the White House and to the Department of Labor and organizing other efforts, was not just because the policy here raised a lot of questions, which, as Fred pointed out, there were a lot of policy and are a lot of policy questions here that are legitimate and things we need to be concerned about and engage with DOL on. But the process they used is also one that caused a lot of concern. Basically, in guidance, which is supposed to be sort of gap-filling the disclosure regulations, kind of helping people answer some of those questions that have proved vexing in terms of, you know, what did the rule really require? When you get down to applying it to the level of, you know, people living with it in the real world, it turns out there are, you know, empty holes, that there are questions to be answered. Instead of using it for that purpose, really, question 30 was going against sort of the tenor of the regulation the entire time, and was in essence an act of attempted rulemaking in a guidance document. And that is a process matter, really is important. Now, I know a lot of us spend time criticizing Washington for being so slow-moving and things never happening, and that's all valid criticism. But one of the places you don't want rapid action without input is in the regulatory process. You don't want these kinds of questions, as we saw in Q30, being decided without any of us having the chance to give input to explain to the department why that may have made sense to them but doesn't make sense in the real world. And in this case, you saw the business community, you know, employers, plan sponsors, joining together with service providers to say, look, brokerage windows are important. They serve a useful function. Our participants like them. You can't just go around and unilaterally attempt to make a change in a guidance document that's going to have this kind of impact. So in the short order is, you know, we won that battle. The White House and others got involved and leaned on the Labor Department to change their mind. In the long term, though, this is now set up as an issue that we're going to be dealing with in the future. In particular, looking at plans that consist only of brokerage windows, the department is essentially given notice in the revised Q39 that while they're no longer going to push for what they were before, they're now going to look at whether that plan design is, in a sense, legitimate, and they're going to continue raising these questions. So it's an example of how things can go wrong, but how we can also right them, and then what we need to look at going forward in terms of watching the department and working with them as policies get developed.
Yeah, it seems to me that at least for conservative plan sponsors, if they're currently have a plan just made up of brokerage accounts, that they should really consider having at least a basic core lineup and allowing participants to invest in those. Isn't there a little bit of forewarned as forearmed here?
Yeah, that's true, and I guess that gets to one of these interesting points, which is how do you react in the real world to things that are going on, to policy debates that are occurring in Washington? I mean, one approach you can take is to say, no, we're going to fight it down this line, and we're going to make sure that brokerage windows come out at the other end doing well, and we're going to not change until we're forced to, and that's one approach you can take. Another is to say, well, you know, this may be a problem in the future. Do I really want to, you know, incur the potential problems of changing it in short order, or do I want to look at ways to mitigate my risk? And our clients, you know, go both ways on those questions. Some of our clients would say, yes, while we want to keep our brokerage windows because that's what our participants want, let's go ahead and put in sort of a 404C compliant structure of, you know, a number of investment options that are there as well. And, you know, part of the, you know, as I've said many times, and some of you are probably sick of hearing me say it, ERISA's strength and its weakness, sort of its benefit and its drawback, is its flexibility. So as a plan sponsor, you can go ahead and structure those things. You have that ability to make those choices to accommodate it. And as you say, for a conservative plan sponsor who has one or more brokerage windows as the only investments, you may want to consider looking at expanding that just as a prophylactic measure. even as you might well join in you know, trying to convince the department that there's nothing wrong with that policy design, with that plan design, which is my personal opinion. I don't see anything wrong with that plan design, and I think this policy the department's attempting to pursue is wrong. But that's different than living with it in the real world.
Now, on another issue where you have both brokerage accounts and already have a core lineup, two big things have happened in the last couple of months. One, by July 1, all the broker-dealers had to make their 408B2 disclosures to the plan sponsors. And two, the Department of Labor just recently came out with Q&A 39 saying that there's an affirmative duty to prudently select and monitor the broker-dealers or the brokerage accounts, if you will, the providers of the brokerage accounts. My reaction to that, Brad, is that, you know, as a part of the process of reviewing the 408B2 disclosures, which I think should take place, say, no later than June 30 of next year, if not before that, it seems to me that there ought to be some affirmative documentation in that the brokerage accounts were benchmarked or compared to other providers, that the services were evaluated, and so that there is a due diligence file with information in it, and then something in the committee minutes that the 408B2 disclosures for the broker-dealer were evaluated, and that the committee made a determination that the arrangement was reasonable and therefore satisfied the exclusion under 408B2. Does that resonate with you? Do you have some additional thoughts on that?
No, I absolutely agree, and I don't think, and this is why I think what the department proposed in this question 30 on brokerage windows, why it was so controversial, is they weren't addressing that kind of a basic question, which is when you select a provider for the brokerage window or the brokerage account, is that a selection of a service provider like any other? And the answer to that, I think, clearly is yes, it is. Therefore, you have to go through a prudent process. You have to monitor the performance of that service provider. You have to understand the fee arrangement, and you have to have determined when selecting that provider that it was appropriate for the plan and that everything was reasonable and that this was a prudent choice. And DOL sort of clouded some of those questions by raising all these other issues about, you know, what are legitimate plan designs utilizing brokerage accounts. And so I think what you just said is very important for folks to remember. And that's why I say, you know, we won the battle and, you know, we'll continue fighting the war later. Having won the battle, really what you need to focus on now is just where you have brokerage windows. Are you following your normal fiduciary process for putting them in place properly, for monitoring their activities, and for ensuring that the right disclosures have been made?
Okay. Well, seeing as we jumped into the frying pan to answer that one, let's jump all the way into the fire now. And Brad, with the briefest of introductions, let's talk about the proposed expansion of fiduciary investment advice, or at least the potential for the reproposal of that regulation. Where are we and where are we going? The floor is yours.
Great. Well, as you all remember, the last year or so, we've had a large debate that was ignited by the Department of Labor's having issued a proposal to redefine who's a fiduciary investment advisor. What conduct is it that makes you someone who's giving fiduciary advice under ERISA and therefore subject to the full panoply of the prohibited transaction rules and everything that goes with that? And the reason that's so significant is that the Labor Department was clearly trying to capture some of the current activities of broker-dealers, agents, and others who don't view themselves as fiduciaries when they give certain information and advice to plans, but who DOL would like to see as fiduciaries. And that would affect some basic compensation and business model issues. For example, a broker-dealer wouldn't be able to engage in principal transactions if that broker-dealer was a fiduciary investment advisor to the plan. So there's some real big-picture issues that come with DOL's proposal here. And that wasn't the only thing DOL addressed in this proposal. It was extraordinarily broad. It addressed the fiduciary status of people who conduct evaluations for ESOPs. It asked questions about rollovers and cross-selling and information regarding distributions. It addressed a whole host of issues. And it generated a lot of controversy because, whereas you might say on Q30 the Labor Department kind of didn't follow the process for issuing a regulation, the allegations against the department for its process in this fiduciary proposal was not that it wasn't using the right process. It was going through the notice and comment rulemaking, but rather that it didn't do so in the right way. And I'll give you an example. The Labor Department in that proposal said that IRA accounts, which are subject to the prohibited transaction rules, this definition of fiduciary would carry over to IRAs as well. So that even though you are selecting your own IRA provider, if that IRA provider gives you advice, that would be fiduciary in nature, which would affect how that IRA provider could be compensated. That's a big deal. That's a $4.5 trillion industry at the time DOL made the proposal. It's bigger now, according to the latest numbers we've seen. There wasn't a single word in the economic analysis that addressed the impact of that change on IRAs. So that's an example of some of those failings. Again, there was a big, broad coalition of folks who came together on a bipartisan basis and said to the Labor Department, you really haven't proved that there's a problem, that you haven't proved the size of the problem that you're trying to solve. You haven't proved that the cost of your proposal is reasonable in light of the problem you're trying to solve. In other words, have you demonstrated that where you want to go with this regulation makes sense to get there? And that's part of the whole regulatory process, is justifying these changes in their economic benefits and costs. And so with a lot of pressure being brought on the department from Congress, from Democrats and Republicans in Congress, from the White House, essentially the White House told the Labor Department to start over and to re-propose this rule. Originally, DOL said they would do that and they would have a re-proposal out by early this year. Obviously, that hasn't happened. And what apparently is happening is that DOL is not going to be issuing this proposal at least until after the election. But that doesn't mean they're not working on it. They're, in fact, working on it quite diligently. And there's been a lot of behind the scenes going back and forth within the administration about what should be in it and what it would look like. So what we have here is a situation where I think this is another one of those times where elections really are going to matter. If President Obama wins re-election, we will see a re-proposal of the fiduciary regulation. And my prediction is that it looks only slightly different. My prediction, if there's a second Obama administration and this rule is re-proposed, is that we'll likely see an actual proposal on dealing with cross-selling and rollovers that makes discussions with a participant about distribution fiduciary advice. And that could have a lot of long-term impacts, that could present a lot of issues for folks who are currently in the business of dealing with IRA solicitations and rollovers. So that's something that we'll have to keep our eye on. Another thing I think they'll do is they will address issues like engaging in principal transactions. I think they will include some prohibited transaction exemptions that permit broker-dealers, for example, to engage in principal transactions. But I don't see them really making a wholesale change to significantly weaken, so to speak, their original proposal. I see them making the minimum accommodations necessary to address their most vocal critics and then going forward with that process. I think, however, if there's a Romney administration, that this regulation essentially disappears. I don't think that there's any reason to believe that a Romney administration is going to place a high priority on changing the definition of fiduciary, given the experience that we've seen and the bipartisan support for DOL going back to the drawing board.
You know, my prognosis is pretty much the same as yours. I think if the Obama administration continues and the leadership of the Department of Labor is the same, that we will get a regulation that probably is just modified enough to reduce some of the criticism, not put out the fire, but to make it a smaller fire. And I actually think that there may be a little tinkering with the definition of fiduciary. But as you said, when you were talking about principal trading, I think what they're going to do to make this more palatable is they're going to expand some of the prohibited transaction exemptions. In other words, for the non-lawyers in the crowd, they're going to allow more conflicts of interest, and certainly in the investment of IRAs, maybe not the rollovers. I tend to agree with Brad that there is a risk that the distributions and rollovers from plans are going to become more highly regulated. But in terms of investing once money is inside an IRA, there may be a fairly broad exemption. Principal transactions where a fiduciary is on one side of the transaction and they're selling out of inventory, I think they'll loosen that also. So there will be relief. My suspicion is most of the relief will be in the and the relaxing of the prohibited transaction rules. And I think a lot of people, when you hear a debate about the fiduciary advice rule, A lot of the objections that people are really expressing are not the definition of fiduciary. It's really because it causes a common transaction to be a prohibited transaction. So anytime
I think you said that very well, and that's something I think we should emphasize. The debate has been less over sort of the standard of care, like how good does your advice have to be, for lack of a, to say in a non-legal way. It's really been the associated ERISA consequences of being a fiduciary, the prohibited transactions. And essentially, the broker-dealer community and others have viewed DOL's original proposal as an attack on their entire business model. And I think, Fred, you're exactly right to emphasize that. There are really two different debates going on here. And if they can address the business model, they do remove a lot of the problems that that have, but not all by any means, but a lot of the problems that really plagued their initial proposal.
Yeah. Well, there's so much we could say about that. But let's move on to something else, just so we make sure we cover something of interest to everybody here. Brad, earlier today, you and I were talking about a recent development and the Office of Management and Budget. Do you want to say a little bit about that just to alert people to something that's going on?
Yeah, I would. It's actually kind of interesting. DOL has gone through what has been unique in my 15 or so years here in Washington. They have never had a period of this long where they had no regulations formally pending at OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, the part of the White House that oversees the regulatory process. You know, normally when a regulation is finished at the agency level, they send it to OMB and the White House for a 90-day review, and then it gets published, and that's sort of the whole process. You can watch where a regulation is by knowing whether it's at OMB or not. Since the beginning of the year, DOL has had almost nothing in that pipeline until a week ago, and that is almost unprecedented. A lot of speculation of why that is. I think a lot of it goes to some of the controversial rules DOL has been working on and a desire not to put a bunch of things on the record at a period in an election year. But last week, DOL put a new one on the OMB list, the first one in literally 5 or 6 months. And it's implementing a provision of Dodd-Frank that deals with reliance on credit rating agencies. And DOL has sent over a proposed regulation to the White House for review that would amend their various class prohibited transaction exemptions, not individual, but class exemptions dealing with that address in some way or that refer in some way to the use of rating agencies. The idea being to reduce reliance on those agencies given some of the criticisms that have been leveled against them with the financial crisis. We don't know what's in that yet because it's not public when it's under White House review. And this is something that could be very just technical and not that interesting, or it could actually be quite substantive, depending on how they've written and what they've done in this proposal. They just sent it over last week, which means we wouldn't see it in the normal course of things until right after the election in early November. So this is a rule we're going to keep our eyes on. Part of the reason this can be significant, though, and this is what Fred and I were talking about, is that there's been a lot of discussion in the retirement income debate right now about how do you get plans more interested in adopting various retirement income solutions. Obviously, some of those solutions, a lot of them involve insurance products and annuitization, and there's a lot of concern on plan sponsors' parts as to how they can select an annuity provider and what's their liability for doing so in terms of the future solvency of that annuity provider. And obviously, rating agencies are one of the factors you would look at. So depending on what they do here, how they're interpreting Dodd-Frank, this could be an issue that could, in its own right, be significant in terms of changing class exemptions, but also could influence, not necessarily for the better, the debate over lifetime income and how you go about selecting an annuity provider.
You know, Brad, I just realized I'm under the – I mean, we all need to pay attention to that to see what comes out. And as you said, I agree, it could be big or it could be mundane. And we're just going to have to wait and see. But we'll know, I guess, about 90 days from now or less because of the general time for processing regulations.
Yeah, the OMB process takes up to 90 days. So in the normal course, it usually takes about 89 days, as one might expect for the government process, for them to kick out the rule and send it back to the agency, and then another 2 weeks or so for it to actually be published in the Federal Register. It's probably worth pointing out, though, that, for example, with the fiduciary regulation, there's been a lot of back-channel communication between the White House and the Department such that it may not take 90 days for them to kick out some of these regulations that have been percolating, not publicly, but percolating nonetheless all this year. So we could see a big flurry of activity right after the election where things move much faster than normal, or they could take their time. This is, again, the point where we have to speculate, but there is the possibility things could move more quickly than we anticipate if there's a second Obama administration.
Yeah, I you know, Brad, I'm of the sense that because it's an election year, a lot of this is being worked on in a collaborative way within the administration, but there's a reluctance to bring on anything controversial, or there's enough controversy going on anyway. As a result, I think in November, December, and January, we could see a lot of activity if Obama is reelected. A lot of activity in the sense of regulations going out over to the OMB and then popping out of there 60, 90 days later. So the first quarter of next year could be pretty interesting for all of us.
Indeed it could, yeah. I think that's very true.
I want to go back to the fiduciary regulation, the fiduciary advice regulation, and just make three quick points that I should have made then. The world is not standing still on that issue. I think there's the Dodd-Frank fiduciary, the directive to the SEC to investigate whether or not there should be a fiduciary rule for all advisors. And there's just an expansion. I think RIAs are performing very successfully in terms of getting business in the mid-market and the large market. And I think that the broker-dealers are beginning, many of them at least, beginning to think, we've got to adapt to that. We have to have either a way to avoid the private transaction rules or a way to be fiduciaries. And three ways that we're seeing that is more and more broker-dealers are rolling out RIA programs for retirement plans where they're going to let their top retirement plan advisors become fiduciaries. So they're adapting to the world in that way. Secondly, more providers are contracting with local or national RIA firms to provide fiduciary advice as a part of their product so that the less experienced brokers can sell it without becoming a fiduciary because this national RIA will provide the fiduciary advice. And then the third thing, which I find really interesting, is that a number of the providers are going to the broker-dealers and saying, hey, we've got a level fee scenario. We will contract with you. And there's a variety of different ways they're doing it. There are different categories or different share classes and so on. But if you know, you can go tell the plan sponsor that you will provide your services either as a broker-dealer, non-fiduciary, or as an RIA fiduciary, but you'll do it for a level fee. You'll get 25 basis points, 35 basis points, 50 across all plan assets. And so even if you're not an acknowledged fiduciary, but you become a functional fiduciary by virtue of giving investment advice, you have not committed a prohibited transaction. So just because this regulation was withdrawn and may be reproposed doesn't mean the rest of the world is standing still. There's a lot of practical efforts going on by broker-dealers who have a significant amount of retirement plan business to adjust their practices so that no matter how the future turns out, they're going to be able to attract advisors who do retirement plans, and they're going to be able to live in the new environment. So life goes on, no matter, notwithstanding some of the fluctuations in rulemaking.
So that's a good point. One thing I think we should emphasize also, and you alluded to the SEC activity in this area, DOL and SEC are pursuing somewhat parallel paths, and they say that they're coordinating closely, but DOL has also made it expressly clear that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to get to the same place. DOL takes the view that their statute is different, their mission is different, being a fiduciary under ERISA is different, and that doesn't mean that, you know, while they'll make every effort to coordinate, that doesn't mean they're going to necessarily be the same, which is somewhat of a cause of concern, because I think there's a real issue about people getting whipsawed between two different governing bodies of regulation over the same conduct. So a lot of things that people have been encouraging DOL to do is to coordinate closely with SEC. And while they pay at least lip service to that, it is still an ongoing concern.
Yeah, the situations are somewhat different, Brad, in the sense that for an individual investor, an RIA or a financial advisor gives advice to the investor about the investor's investments. With a ERISA-governed participant-directed plan, the advisor gives advice to the plan committee about the investments, but the advisor's duty of loyalty runs to the participants, whom the advisor may never meet. It's actually the fiduciary relationship in ERISA is actually a very odd animal. And I think it is some justification for some differences, at least.
I think that's true, and we've seen that historically, but there is a real question as to how you make them fit together comfortably, recognizing some valid difference. And one of the concerns that's been a running theme by Congress and other folks criticizing DOL's fiduciary proposal, the old regulation, which we'll see in the new one, you know, probably after the election, was to make sure it's more harmonized than not.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. In the real world, when I have broker-dealers and RIAs come to me looking for advice in this area, we end up spending 90% of our time on the prohibited transaction rules. So like you said earlier, the fiduciary standard of care is something that it may not be embraced by everybody, but at least it isn't inflammatory. I mean, people will say, hey, yeah, we can, for the most part, we'll say that they can live with it. It's really over in the prohibited transaction area where under the securities laws you can disclose away most conflicts, but under ERISA you can't.
Right.
And that's really, just everybody in the audience knows, you know, when Brad and I aren't talking theory, when we're actually representing clients, the work really primarily occurs over on the prohibited transaction side.
True.
Brad, let me try to cover one subject quickly, and then I'll come back to you. We talked earlier about that Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-02, where the Department of Labor issued nominally additional explanations about the participant disclosure regulation. And we talked about questions 30 and 39. Let me talk about Q&A 28 for a minute. You may not remember the number, but Q&A 28 is the one that dealt with asset allocation models and said that in some cases, perhaps many cases, an asset allocation model could be viewed as an investment. If it's viewed as an investment and it's offered to participants, it's a DIA, a designated investment alternative. The minute something is a designated investment alternative, then you have to do all kinds of disclosures to participants. 1, 5, and 10-year performance history of the asset allocation model, the expense ratio of the asset allocation model, including the underlying funds, the turnover ratio for the asset allocation model, and so on. I mean, I just named a few as examples. There's a lot more than what I said. Well, that got the advisory community up in arms. But when you read the details of the regulation, actually we heard about it first that it might happen. When the guidance came out in the Field Assistance Bulletin, it was actually watered down a little bit. And I think the advisory community by and large heaved a sigh of relief and went on about their business thinking, my asset allocation models aren't designated investment alternatives. I think that's wrong. I think that was the wrong conclusion. If you read Q&A 28 closely, it says you have to satisfy three conditions for your asset allocation model to not be a designated investment alternative. First, it has to be clearly presented to the participants, which means to me in writing, as merely a means of allocating assets among the designated investment alternatives. So if nothing else, there needs to be a statement to the participants that says this asset allocation model is not an investment alternative. It is simply a tool to assist you in allocating your account assets among the designated investment alternatives offered by the plan. Secondly, it has to clearly explain to the participants how the model portfolio functions. This is how the model portfolio functions. Fill in the blank. I think it takes, a short paragraph at least to explain that. And then third, it has to clearly explain how the model portfolio differs from the plan's designated investment alternatives. Those are three separate things that have to be done going forward to avoid having an asset allocation model be treated as a designated investment alternative. Nobody wants their asset allocation models to be treated as designated investment alternatives that I've talked to so far, because they can't collect and report that information to participants. And if you can't collect and report it, any fiduciary in their right mind will kick the model off their platform. And in fact, I'm aware of some record keepers who will no longer accept them on their platforms if there isn't that kind of disclosure that can be made. So that presents some pretty interesting and difficult issues on a practical level. First, who's going to write all those disclosures? If you're an RIA or if you're a financial advisor on this call, who's writing those disclosures for you? Secondly, this information has to go to the participants initially before when they're first eligible to participate, before they can first direct their investments, and it has to go out again annually in writing. How are you going to get that done? Is the record keeper or the bundle provider going to support you in doing that? Are they distributing it for you? Are you going to have to do it on your own? I just think people are missing a significant issue here, and it could blow up somewhere down the road. So make sure you look at Q&A 28. Make sure you're complying with those conditions, assuming that you don't want to be a designated investment alternative.
Yeah, I think Fred, you said that very well, because I think were it not for Q30 and the brokerage window controversy, I think Q28 actually would have been the question that everyone was really concerned with. As it was overshadowed by the brokerage window debate. But Q30 essentially is creating an intermediate level of disclosure between sort of the minimum required by the regulation and designated investment alternative status, where if your model portfolio, your model asset allocation product there, is solely composed of otherwise investments that are DIAs under the plan already, then it's not itself a DIA, provided you make these disclosures. And I don't think people have fully understood those conditions because they aren't particularly well discussed. So it creates a bit of a concern, I think, for people as a compliance matter and as understanding what exactly their model portfolios are. And I think there's also an open question as to what the target date rules, new disclosures about target dates that DOL, it's a regulation DOL is considering, how it might impact model portfolios as well. But it's an area you should, as Fred said, definitely go back and reread Q28 and make sure you're providing those disclosures.
Brad, we're down to the last 4 or 5 minutes here. Let me, before we open it up to Q&As, maybe I can ask you a couple questions from our long list, and we could deal with some straightforward but very interesting issues. The first one is that, obviously, July 1 has come and gone. That was the effective date for the disclosures by covered service providers to existing plans. The failure to do it meant that the service provider, covered service provider arrangement with the plan became a prohibited transaction, and on and on and on. It's a parade of horrors. That gets us to my question. It's the next step is going to be for the DOL to start enforcing 408B2. And they would do that through investigations. What do you hear about what's going on in terms of training, investigations, anything like that?
Yeah, this is a very interesting area because, first of all, we have already had clients who have received their new letters that DOL is coming to do an investigation since January 1st, and already that standard information letter that you get that has the laundry list of things they want now includes show us your 408B2 disclosures. So it's now a standard part of basically every plan investigation that's going on. The interesting thing is, while it's now a standard part and the information is being requested, DOL is still in the midst of trying to train its staff to know what it is they're looking for. And this is a real just practical challenge for the agency. They've had a lot of turnover in staff due to an aging workforce. They've got a lot of new people to begin with, on top of which they're looking at having to train all those people, and roughly two-thirds of their staff's out in the field. So we're looking at maybe, 300 or 400 or 500 investigators, somewhere in that range, who are going to have to be trained on the details of what's required and how it works. And there's still, of course, open questions and ambiguities about some of the requirements of the rule. So if you get one of those letters, expect to have to provide those disclosures, but also expect that the investigator you're dealing with, at least for the next year, is himself or herself learning what those rules are. So we anticipate a lot of back and forth with the department on our clients who are being investigated as we work with with them to make sure that DOL has the same understanding we do of what the rules are. And in some ways, some of you might actually be well ahead of DOL. You may actually know much more about it because you spent 2 years getting ready to implement it. And DOL investigators are only now really starting that process because until it was finalized and out there, there was nothing to train them on. So it's going to be an interesting year or two transition as we go through and work with investigators and deal with those cases as they arise.
Couple of quick comments on that. One, keep in mind that plan sponsors have a duty to evaluate those disclosures to make sure that they got them all and that they're complete. Otherwise, the plan sponsor could enter into a prohibited transaction. So there's
that's a great point. This is a two-way street.
Yeah, prohibited transaction issue. And there's a fiduciary issue. That is that the plan committees, the responsible plan fiduciaries, have to evaluate them. And if you look at the Tussey versus ABB case, the court said you have to have a baseline to do an evaluation. The court said it didn't see how you could possibly evaluate compensation without some baseline or benchmarking information. And then three, about 6-7 weeks from now, we're going to do a webcast on how plan sponsors should review their 408B2 disclosures. So that's in the future. But make sure that your plan sponsor clients keep all that information in a due diligence file so they can, you know, after they've reviewed it for prohibited transactions and for fiduciary compliance, so that if the DOL investigator comes in the next 2-3 years, they've got it there to provide it. Otherwise, it could create some difficulties. Brad, my last question. If we segue from DOL investigations generally to service provider investigations, we've seen an uptick in the DOL investigations of service providers like third-party administrators, RIAs, broker-dealers, record keepers, and so on. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that is definitely true. We've seen that both anecdotally and people I've talked to at the department have confirmed that they've been doing more service provider investigations. And there's several factors that are coming together for that. One is that the DOL has been expanding its consultant and advisors enforcement project for a number of years now. And that's a project where they're looking at, you know, who's being paid for what? What are they disclosing? What are they not disclosing? You know, is everything the arrangement between the service providers and consultants and the plans, is everything being done as it should be? And part of that investigation over time, so the results from that are part of what informed DOL's fiduciary proposal. So there's a lot of interest at the department in getting into some of these relationships that are on the line as far as when you're a fiduciary, when you're not, and all the issues that flow from that. Another thing is just frankly, we're seeing a huge emphasis on fees here. We have these two new regulations going into place. There's a little bit of doing a baseline survey so that DOL can measure the effectiveness of these regulations going forward. Before they went into effect, here's what compliance was. After they went into effect, here's what compliance was, and here's what the outcomes were, so that you can actually look back and measure the impact the regulation has had, or at least make some way of measuring it. Whether you agree it actually measures it or not is a different question. But there's definitely been an uptick in that activity, and we've seen an awful lot of service providers who are getting essentially just random audits to come and look at what they're doing. The only good news is most of those have been fairly amicable. We've generally been able to resolve those. They've not been necessarily searching for a particular violation. They've more just been looking at what's going on in the aggregate.
Yeah, I bet our attorneys are involved, the attorneys in our firm are involved in at least 15 of those service provider investigations right now representing the service providers. But agreeing with what Brad said, it does seem like these are survey investigations where they're primarily fact-gathering and that the DOL investigators aren't really that sophisticated on the issues yet, particularly issues like revenue sharing and other indirect payments that may not be obvious. But, of course, with 408B2, those are going to become obvious. Operator, can we open it up for questions now?
Oh, absolutely. Well, ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. You'll hear a voice prompt letting you know that your line is open and it is not necessary that you state your name before posing your question. Once again, that is star one. If you would like to ask a question, caller, your line is open.
Hello?
Yes, hi. Several questions, but just one here regarding participant disclosure. My wife recently received hers from her company or her service provider, And in keeping with the spirit of the new regulations, I just want to know what your thoughts are. The email was very, very vague. It just says, due to a new regulatory requirement, please go to your participant website, which I did. I had her log in. It didn't discuss anything. It didn't describe anything in detail what that new regulatory requirement was. I found it. It was the fee disclosure, but that the average participant is not going to see that. Is that keeping with the spirit of the new regulation, in your opinion?
Brad, are you on?
Yeah, no, I would say that the requirement isn't so much explaining why the disclosure's been there, so I wouldn't view it as a failure to comply to not explain the origin of the 404A5 regulation. Really, what's important is whether the information that regulation requires is there and is there in a way that does explain the information that is required. For example, it provides that 1, 5, and 10-year track history about the investments, kind of in that comparative format that's required by August 30th. So the issue for me wouldn't be, did they explain all about the history of 404A5, but rather, did they provide the information 404A5 requires?
Okay.
Yeah, I think you raised two questions. The first is, there's some pretty strict rules about electronic disclosure. It is possible to comply with them, but with 80 or 90% of the client, the plan sponsor clients that I represent, they would have difficulty complying with the electronic disclosure rules because they're actually quite restrictive. As you were talking, the first thing that came to my mind is, oh my God, are they trying to get around the electronic disclosure rules? We don't have time to go into any detail on that, but I can tell you they're difficult. The second thing, and they apply to participants, not to 408B2 plan sponsor disclosures, because those can be done electronically, but to participant disclosures. The second thing is, I want to point out something Brad said. There should have been a comparative format where all the investments are listed, disclosures are made about performance and expenses, the category of investments. There should have been something like that was very clear and quite easy to read and digest.
Fred, that was, but getting to that, it was because I'm in the industry, I knew how to get to it, and I had to go through several screens on her website, on her provider's website to find it. It was there, but the average participant would probably not find it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I will tell you, generally speaking, the mix of both 408B2 and 404A5 disclosures that I'm seeing goes from awful to exceptionally good. And I don't know if there's going to be any immediate consequence to awful, but it seems to me that the department may cut people a little slack for these initial disclosures, because if you think about it, I can't imagine how many millions of disclosures had to go out over the last few months. But I think the department is going to observe what's going on, and they're going to tighten up some of their rules to deal with what they see as the problem areas. That's just a guess. I mean, I don't know much about it.
Yeah, I would agree. Typically, the department will be a little more engaged on compliance assistance than on enforcement, whacking people with a hammer in the first year of a regulation, particularly one of this scope. The issue there would be, would they perceive it as the service provider trying to make that information difficult to assess versus just not having a very user-friendly system? And if there's an intent there, that's where they're going to be looking at more of a sanction approach. If it's just, hey, we were trying to put it together and we were running out of time and this is the best we could do, but we're going to refine it later, I think DOL would give them more slack.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks. Well, by the way, everybody, if there are a couple more questions, we'll hang on for a few extra minutes. We're not going to do a hard close within reason if you all have questions. Is there another question?
There are indeed. Please go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Hi. You're on. You're live.
Okay. In regards to the 408B2, I guess it's kind of two-pronged. I have to agree, we're a consulting administrative firm, and most of the ones that we've seen from the advisors have been kind of in the bad category in terms of what's been provided. But I guess the question is, it seems like the regulation that's got the most teeth to it is the 408B2. If you don't give your participant disclosures, I think the only ramification is your loss of your 404C compliant, whereas you have all your excise taxes and reversal of fees under the 408B2. Is that correct?
Well, it's also a fiduciary breach to not provide the participant disclosures, but whether that results in a loss would determine a lot of the financial impact.
Yeah, I agree with Brad. It's a fiduciary rule. I guess the DOL could come in on an investigation and mandate that it be done. They would mandate the employer, because keep in mind, the 404A5 participant disclosures are a burden imposed on the employer in its capacity as the ERISA plan administrator, the so-called capital A administrator, where 408B2 is not only is it not a fiduciary rule, it's a prohibited transaction rule. It's imposed on the service provider. 408B2 and the prohibited transaction rules act with vengeance. They are tough. And all these rules, by the way, can be enforced by private litigation as well as by DOL enforcement.
Now, if fees are refunded, they're refunded back to the plan?
For a prohibited transaction?
Yeah, for 408B2.
Yeah, there's some fine-tuning that's going to have to be done by the courts, but is it all the fees because the whole arrangement is unreasonable? Is it just the non-disclosed fees? There's a lot of stuff that we don't know about the details yet, but the general rule is it's got to be refunded. It's a prohibited transaction under 4975 of the Internal Revenue Code as well. That it can involve the imposition of an excise tax. If the DOL recovers it, there's a 20% penalty under 502L, interest, yada, yada. It's a nightmare, an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, though, just to – I don't want people to get the misimpression that there aren't penalties for messing up your participant disclosures, particularly if you're a large plan sponsor. You probably remember the last 5 to 7 years, we've had a raft of class action litigation that went against large service providers and large plans, and among their allegations was you didn't provide the right disclosures to participants. Otherwise, they would have seen all these high fees you were charging, and therefore you owe us $400 million. There now is a fiduciary duty to provide that fee disclosure that did not exist at the time those class actions were brought, and the courts largely kicked those portions of the claims out because there was no such duty. Now there is such a duty. So the larger your plan is, the more potential at risk there is, I think, from a litigation standpoint, to not doing your disclosures properly. So don't get the misimpression this doesn't matter. It does. It's a fiduciary duty of the plan administrator, and it's something that they need to take seriously.
We've got, I guess, 10 people queued up. Maybe we'll try to go bang, bang, bang and answer their questions.
A speed round.
Yeah, this is the speed round.
And caller, please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, I was wondering about what kind of protection you feel there is available with the good faith compliance Q&A of the field assistance bulletin. I believe it was question and answer 37.
Brad?
And that's real, but it is limited. I mean, basically, we would certainly use that for a client. The DOL said, "Hey, you didn't do this right." We'd say, "Look, we did the best we could. We were doing it in good faith, but this is complicated, hard stuff, et cetera, et cetera." It has value. It's not as strong as we would have liked DOL to state it, and it doesn't cut off that private right of action, by a participant to sue. But it is helpful in terms of your interactions with DOL. So it's good to have it, but it's not a get out of jail free card either.
Yeah, I agree.
What's the time frame? A year or can you areas day one?
Well, for our clients, it's a year. For everybody else, it's December.
I mean, your point is correct. The longer
if you wait. If you want to engage us, we're available. I would say one of the requirements is that you have a plan to correct it. So if
right.
you actually have a plan in place to correct it, then, yeah, anything reasonable. It'll be a year before the DOL probably really pushes the issue very hard anyway. But you need to have a plan in place. I think the real answer is a reasonable time. If it's a systems issue, a data collection issue or something like that, yeah, that takes a while. If it's just that you missed something, then realistically they could reasonably expect for that to be corrected more quickly.
I mean, the bottom line is the longer you wait, the harder it is to claim that. So a year strikes me as kind of on the outside edge of reasonableness.
Yeah.
Right, thank you.
Caller, please go ahead with your question.
Hello.
Hey. I have a client that's got a platform where all the 401k investments are run through the platform, and we also have two pooled brokerage accounts that have different, investment philosophies, and the employees are allowed to pick either the platform or one of these other two pooled investment brokerage windows to invest their profit sharing money. Would that be considered a DIA, a designated investment alternative? Reporting?
Yeah, I assume there's an RIA who's signing on as a 338 investment manager for the brokerage accounts that's manage them in a conservative or growth or whatever style. Is that right?
Correct. Well, yes and no. I mean, one's a, they run it through Schwab. I don't think they've signed on as a fiduciary. One of them was, because one of them is Morgan Stanley.
Whoever manages money, whoever has the discretion to buy and sell investments is a fiduciary regardless of whether they sign on or not.
Okay.
So there's somebody there who's making buy and sell decisions. It seems to me, since that's not, I don't think it's what the regular, the field assistance policy calls a DIM, a DIM, a designated investment manager, because a DIM has to manage it in a style appropriate for that participant, which suggests there's some involvement in getting the, in determining the participant's needs. So I would think it would be a designated investment alternative. Brad, I don't know. I've never dealt with that question.
Yeah, I would say I would treat it as such for compliance purposes, even if you might have a technical argument that it's not. I would agree it's not going to be a DIM because a DIM has to be individualized. But for safety's sake, I would, in terms of conservative compliance, I would treat it as a DIA. Frankly, the question of what's a DIA is more open and awkward than one would have thought. This is something that we're all going to be wrestling with on technical issues, very facts and circumstances oriented questions, looking particularly at what those are, exactly how they're set up, and then decide whether you think the legal risk of DOL saying it is a DIA is worth the utility to view of saying it's not. So that's a nice weaselly ERISA lawyer answer to say it depends, but unfortunately sometimes it does, and I think that's where that might be.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Please go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Hi. We are an advisory firm, and we get involved designing custom asset allocation models and take 338 fiduciary responsibilities for them. But it's not unusual for us to wall off to participants certain non-core asset classes in order to avoid them unsophisticated investor possibly hurting themselves. It sounds like what you're saying, this makes our models a DIA.
I think that's a common reading of Q&A 28. It doesn't come out and say that, but it says you have to explain that it's merely a method for allocating investments among the DIAs. Well, if you're adding non-DIA investments into the mix when you're managing the money, seems pretty clear to me there's no way you can say that it's merely a method of allocating among the DIAs. Therefore, I think you're stuck.
Even though that those non-core investments might be determined to be imprudent for the participants because of sophistication?
It doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. It just means you need to give 5 and 10-year performance history. You need to give turnover ratios. You need to give expense ratios. And you need to give the top 10 holdings. Just think of all those rules about mutual fund disclosures. And the DOL rules are pretty similar to the SEC rules.
Okay,
I'm not sure we necessarily understood your question properly, though. Were you saying there are certain DIAs you exclude from your model portfolio?
There are certain investments that we would only include in the model because they're non-core.
Gotcha.
And participants that are unsophisticated might hurt themselves by overutilizing, let's say, a REIT.
Right.
Or emerging markets fund or whatever.
I'm the only one who misheard it, so I apologize. Fred's absolutely correct. It's a non-DIA, off-menu investment. You're going to be in DIA territory.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We'll take our next question.
Hello.
Kind of on this theme of the participant disclosure, since that's what we've been stuck on, my question is regarding making changes to the core fund lineup or removing or adding DIAs. I'm having trouble finding specific area in the code, but from what I'm reading from some of the document provider's interpretation, it looks like an addendum or possibly the whole annual notice needs to be resubmitted if the chart has changed. Example being, if new investments are added at a quarterly fund review, 30 to 90 days before it's available to the participants. That sounds like a pretty burdensome addition to the process. Is that the spirit of what they're going for there?
Yeah, I mean, dealing with that specific rule, if you're going to remove an investment and put a new one in, now participants are going to have to, you know, a designated investment, alternative investment, a core lineup investment. Now the fiduciaries are going to have to give a notice to participants 30 to 90 days before. Many people have been giving 30 and 60-day notices, many providers, in any event, because they were trying to comply with the Aetna provision from the OL Advisory Opinion 97-16A. So that was in certain circles a fairly common practice already.
Well, I'm not sure I asked the question properly. I'm referring to the annual disclosure needing to be resubmitted. The notice, as you stated, is quite common, but is the whole, you know, 13-page annual notice, since the chart and all the information is changing and funds might be going away, does that whole disclosure need to be added again? That's where some of the service providers seem to be having some trouble on getting that information updated before. Just giving them a notice but not giving them a lot of detail doesn't seem to be a problem, but giving them the notice and the proper format, it seems to be a little bit more of an issue, and some of the service providers seem to feel that that's not necessary.
I'm going to give you some good news and some bad news. The bad news is you can't rely on the good news because I can't remember for sure. The good news is that my recollection, and there's some fairly detailed rules on that, but my recollection, again, which you can't rely on because I'm a little bit shooting from the hip here, my recollection is that you can attach that 30 to 90-day notice to the prior year's comparative format chart and use that for the rest of the year. But then for the following year, you have to look at the status of the plan on December 31. You also have to update the website on a quarterly basis.
Right.
I think
that's my recollection as well, yeah.
And is the DOL checking up on those the way you said they are, the 408B2, as part of their standard request?
They will be, but they haven't yet because it doesn't go into effect until August 30th. So
right.
Just as, you know, if you got a letter from DOL on May 25th, it didn't include the 408B2 information, although they might well have requested it since. But after August 30th, it'll be a standard part of their investigation information request.
Thank you.
Caller, please go ahead with your question.
Hello.
Hello. I was questioning the actual notice itself, the 404A5, and how that, when we're reporting this information on an annual basis, how we would report benchmarking for employer stock, or if that's part of the disclosure requirement.
There are special sections on employer stock and the regulation. I don't recall the benchmarking methodology that they use in that section. I don't know if you do, Brad.
But that
well
is required.
Enough, not well enough to give you advice on a phone call. We'd have to look it up. But there is guidance on how to do that.
Okay, so there is a requirement on that. Okay, as well as the...
It has its own unique section in the back of the regulation, so it's there somewhere. Go find it.
Okay.
Okie doke.
Thanks.
Caller, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello.
Is anybody looking at the – I've read somewhere that Fidelity has something like 11 million participants and only had 600 calls about the fee disclosure by the participants. Is anybody checking at DOL, do they care about the expense to provide – the plan sponsors having to bear for this?
I mean, in their economic analysis, they go through and they try to predict the benefit that participants will derive from having this information and the theoretically better decisions they'll make versus the cost of providing it. Obviously, the cost of providing 70 million participants with disclosures is colossal. I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. In the economic analysis that we did in the Bush administration, when, just in full disclosure, I was, we proposed the first version of the participant disclosure rule when I was the Assistant Secretary, and it was finalized under the Obama administration. In ours, we estimated about a third of participants would find this information useful. In the Obama administration, they estimated that about two-thirds of participants would, which obviously makes it cheaper as a cost-benefit analysis. What the actual number is, I have also heard from some of our clients who are large service providers that they've had very few calls. But I think part of that is because there's really two parts that participants get, and the first one, I think, is less likely to cause comment than the second. By August 30th, everyone gets this comparative document, but it's basically laying out what people already knew, just in a more user-friendly format, or at least could have known had they wanted to look at the information. The quarterly benefit statement, which is due by November 14th, could contain actual new information that might engender participants to make calls. And that's the administrative expense that would need to be broken out as a dollar amount for that account for the prior quarter. And if your plan pays administrative expenses directly, there would be an actual number, say $32, that would be on the quarterly benefit statement that might well cause participants to say, why the heck am I paying $32? This is brand new. What's going on? And call. On the other hand, your plan may not pay those directly. They may pay it out of 12b-1 fees or something else where the cost of that administrative expense is shown in the net operating cost of the investment itself, in which case the quarterly benefit statement will only have a footnote. So how many people see the notice in the quarterly benefit statement, how many of them see a dollar amount, and then how many of them call is kind of a big unknown. But I think most folks looking at this expect in November that notice to generate a lot more calls than what we've seen so far related to the August 30th deadline.
Everybody, we've got time for one more call and one more question, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. I appreciate your interest. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everybody. Operator?
Please go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Fred?
Yeah.
The 10 questions back, you indicated that the 408B2 disclosures, some awful, some great. Could you describe an awful?
I got one. Where, you know, I write these things. I write 404A5 and 408B2 disclosures for provider clients. And I got one that I couldn't even figure out. It didn't have a number in it anywhere. It had all kinds of links to other things. And after reading about 20 or 30 pages of fine print, by going through the links, I just couldn't. There's no way in the world that I could figure out how much that plan was paying. That is awful. I think the biggest failing, that one was just uniquely bad. But I think the more common failing, the more common weakness, is that 408B2 says you have to provide, that you can use percentages, you can use fractions, you can use basis points, you can use estimates, you can do a lot of different things. You can use ranges. But you have to provide the responsible plan fiduciary with the information necessary to evaluate your compensation. Well, if somebody says our fees are between 0 and 2% per year, and that is a $100,000 plan, then maybe you could just assume 2% and do your evaluation. But what if that were a $50 million plan? 2% would be ridiculous. It'd be not only excessive, it would be off the charts excessive. So how could the committee of that $50 million plan possibly take that information and evaluate whether or not they're paying a reasonable amount of compensation? Under the regulation, the preamble to the 408B2 regulation, I believe that committee now has a fiduciary duty to send a letter to that service provider saying, we can't evaluate your compensation based on your disclosure, we need more information. It may be, certainly they have a fiduciary duty. They may even have an obligation under the prohibited transaction rules to do that. So that would be, I mean, the one was extreme, but that's an example of the more common weakness that we see. So
also a weakness on services being specific?
No, you know, it varies a lot. I mean, if you look at the record keepers and you look at the third-party administrators, they're both used to giving very, very detailed explanations of their services. So in those categories, for the most part, the disclosures we've seen are pretty good. With the RIA firms that we've worked with, we take and divide the services into four categories: fiduciary services at the plan level, non-fiduciary services at the plan level, fiduciary services at the participant level, and non-fiduciary services at the participant level. So at least the ones we've worked on, I think there's a fairly robust description of the services. Now, it's by category. It's not, you know, paragraphs on each service, but still enough for the plan sponsor to evaluate. I think the covered service providers that have been the most burdened by this are the broker-dealers, because their compensation structures are the most complicated. There are just so many different forms of compensation. And, you know, for a broker-dealer, let's say that had to, by July 1, send out 5,000 disclosure documents, some of them on brokerage accounts, some of them on group annuity contracts, some of them on open architecture platforms, some of them on mutual fund direct platforms, some of them on investment managers. And that's only 5% of their overall business as a broker-dealer. That is an enormous burden. Having said that, that's because it's such an enormous burden, that's probably also where they've struggled the most to provide detailed descriptions of services and detailed descriptions of compensation. I think now the burden is shifted to the Department of Labor to come out and say either that's enough, I mean, to give additional guidance, maybe additional frequently asked questions. Either that's enough or we expect more, and here's what we expect. Because right now, even among the broker-dealers, I'm seeing some great ones and I'm seeing some awful ones. Even among the broker-dealers, there's a huge range of how they've interpreted, and the good ones are looking at the people who make disclosures that can't be figured out and saying, gee, if that's the rule, we way overdid it. And there's some pretty credible broker-dealers who made some weak disclosures, in my opinion. Something's going to become the norm within the broker-dealer community. If the Department of Labor doesn't speak up, then it will be the one that has the least cost associated with it, which would not be good.
Well, just a couple of thoughts. One, the Department of Labor has announced its intention to offer sort of a mandatory form of uniform form of disclosure. They've not done that yet. They've not proposed the rule, so that's probably a 1-3 year project. But at some point, DOL says it's going to do that, you know, to provide a little bit of standardization. Secondly, I would also point out, though, that, you know, because of the emphasis on fees, that's become a bit of a selling point for a lot of service providers to be clear, to be upfront, and to explain why they can walk you, the plan, you know, fiduciary, through this minefield of regulation and be the ones to help you. And so there can be competitive advantages to being more clear, just as there can be competitive disadvantages. And I think the jury's still out on exactly how the market's going to shake out in terms of obfuscatory disclosures versus clear disclosures. The last thing I'll say is just the violation I've seen that I call the to the extent violation, and is one that you should keep out for, is someone who says, I'm a fiduciary to the extent I do fiduciary things. That doesn't cut it as a disclosure as to whether you're a fiduciary for 408B2. But we've seen some of those.
Yeah, I've seen those also.
Guys, you did a great job on this call. I really...
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate the kind words.
Well, and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, that is all the time we have for questions. Fred and Brad, I'll turn it back to you for closing remarks.
Well, you know, this is the first one, and we're going to do them quarterly. I hope you all found value in it. You know, with Brad's position, prior position in Washington, D.C., and with the amount of work that we do with the DOL and the Department of Treasury and the PBGC, we have some insights that we think can be valuable to you all, and this is how we plan to share them. So thank you, and enjoy the rest of summer, and I'll probably see some of you all after Labor Day. Bye-bye.
And we'll hopefully hear from you next quarter. Thank you again.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our conference for today. We thank you all for your participation.